In Paul's first letter to the Corinthians, he wrote to the unmarried and widows and said, "It is good for them to stay unmarried, as I am. But if they cannot control themselves, they should marry, for it's better to marry than burn with passion." Most people find that as a reason for getting married, beneath their dignity or something like that. It seems a fairly poor and low and animalistic reason that if you cannot control your sexual urges, you should seek to marry. Whereas if you can, then you should be glad to remain single. Seems well and truly out of keeping with our society's views, let alone our Christian church's kind of views. And yet it was the view of the apostle, which I'm going to commend to you today as we look at the subject of marriage, starting off in Genesis, because that's what our series is on. "I want a girl just like the girl that married dear old dad." It was a song that was sung in my father's generation, not mine, you'll be glad to know, and which Sigmund Freud no doubt could understand. It has a great truth in it, as indeed much of Freud has, that our attitudes, especially on the subject of family, are created right back in the beginnings with our family itself. That we have a culturally, socially, microculturally, family kind of influence and effect upon us, which is almost overwhelming because of its subconscious character. And almost inevitably, you will wind up marrying somebody just like your mum in one or two or three or many respects, unless, of course, you're a girl and then you'll marry someone just like your dad. That is the character of life. And it gives you a rude shock when you see it in your partner. And your expectations to what kind of wife you should be or what kind of husband you should be will also come from the kind of wife and husband you saw your parents to be. For Christians, then, it is very hard to think Christianly about marriage. Almost inevitably, you will think in terms of your family subculture or your society culture as a whole, but your family in particular. In our culture here, we have certain choices about marriage. Choices of whom we should marry and whether we should marry, choices of when we marry and how we marry. You can have a marriage nowadays with or without children. You can have one as a single event for the whole of your life or a series of them, one after another. That is, marriages, not necessarily children. You can have a liberated style of marriage. You can have a very chauvinistic style of marriage. You can have all kinds of different marital patterns available to you over which we make choices. But unfortunately, Christians are making the choices of their society rather than the choices of the Scriptures. And that is reinforced, of course, because it's very hard to avoid making the choices of your own family. And so we go back to Genesis and through the Bible to try and see the biblical framework upon which we are to make those choices, which will lead us in our end conclusions to attitudes quite radically different to our societies, and I suspect most likely radically different to our parents, even if they are Christian parents. And so this afternoon at 2 o'clock, when we have our coffee time here and many of us hang around, we thought we'd actually formalise it a little bit after we've got a bit of tea and coffee. We'll have a question time here in the theatre if you're free to stay for that and want to stay for that. So let us get on our running shoes, because we're going to get through a lot of material fairly quickly. First of all, marriage. It starts off right back in Genesis 1. That's where it starts, with the creation that is good, and the description of God creating all things to fulfill his purpose, the creation of all things that are good, the creation of a garden paradise in which marriage plays a part. It's part of the good in chapter 1. It's part of the perfect garden paradise in chapter 2. That is, marriage, just like work, is not part of the curse of sin and the fall. Marriage is part of the good things that God has created for us to enjoy, or if I can put it more crudely for you, sex is part of the good things that God has created for us to enjoy. It's not part of the fallen, sinful world. Man and woman are first of all created in the image of God. And the first reference to sex is that within the image of God picture at the end of chapter 1. The male and female, he created them in his image to rule the world under his authority. That is, notice, woman is not subhuman. She's not second rate or second class at all in that creation character, but part and parcel of humanity that God made to rule the world, his rule, is male and female, and they, I suggested a couple of weeks back, find their fulfillment in the person of Christ. It is as in the image of God, male and female, that they are to multiply, to fulfill the earth, be fruitful and increase and fill it and subdue it. Together they are to do it, male and female. However, it's in chapter 2 that the relationship within humanity is spelt out. That is, in chapter 1, you have the relationship of man and woman to God and man and woman to the rest of the world. But in chapter 2, you have spelt out the relationship of man to woman and woman to man. And it's in that context, for the first time, that something is said to be not good in chapter 2, verse 18. When God creates man alone, he sees it is not good for man to be alone. God, therefore, creates... seeing this need, creates for this need a fellowship of a helper. He perceives that we are gregarious, social creatures, built for relationship and in need of relationship. It's something that we, of course, know of ourselves, don't we? That we need to be loved and we need to love. We do not function well in solitary. We do not function well locked up by ourselves. We actually function in social relationships. And God, seeing this need, seeks to create a helper fit for the man. And what is said of this helper, firstly, is that the helper has to be similar to the man. So the first set of creatures created for the man's fellowship needs are the animals, none of which are satisfactory, because none of which are of the same character as the man. Now, friends, some people have great difficulties in relating in the early chapters of Genesis with modern scientific discoveries one way or another. I think those problems are nothing compared to the problems of sorting out how Genesis relates to Genesis. In chapter 1, the animals are created first and then man. In chapter 2, man is created first, then the animals. If you can sort out that, then you might like to have a chat to Mr. Darwin. But until you've sorted out that, all the discussion with or without Mr. Darwin seems to me to be fairly irrelevant. The picture here is a man created first, and then all the creatures being created for man, and then the woman being created, which just in ordering is quite different to the ordering you get in chapter 1. Although the points that are being spoken to are really much the same. Man is the pinnacle of creation in chapter 1 of all the creatures, and indeed in chapter 2 as well. However, that's a side issue. The point that's noticed here is that none of the animals fulfill the need for man's fellowship. And so God creates the woman out of the man so that bone of bone, flesh and flesh, she is the same stuff and substance as the man, thoroughly similar and therefore one with whom he can be in relationship, the relationship of which God is aiming, that is the relationship of unity. To be united in this relationship as what is God is aiming, the two becoming one flesh, to be united requires them to be similar. But it also requires them to be diverse, to be different to each other. Just as it is essential to be similar in order to have the relationship of unity, it is also essential to be different in order to have the relationship of unity. So God doesn't create a second man, he creates a woman, someone similar and yet complementary and thus different. It is because the kind of relationship that God is concerned with. He wants to make 1 plus 1 equal 1. He does not want 1 plus 1 equaling 2. He doesn't want 2 rulers of the universe. He doesn't want 2 humanities. He doesn't want to set up 2 tribes in the world with the possibilities of their warfare. He wants to set up 1 mankind. That is, the basic unit of humanity is a man plus a woman. The two becoming one. The basic unit is built there on marriage right from the beginning. Now, that's going to have some problems for some of you who are not married and who are not planning to marry. You say, well, does this mean that I am somehow subhuman, that I am not in that marriage relationship? Well, we'll come to that in due time. You can just hang in your subhuman feelings for a while. But the aim, you see, is one mankind. And therefore, to make one mankind, he has a second creature that is similar to the first and therefore able to be united with, and different from the first and therefore no rival to the first, but one with whom there can be unity. And the unity that is set up there is a unity that overwhelms all other relationships. And so the man is to leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two become one. Even that relationship, which you would think is fundamental, of the biological parents and children, doesn't take precedence over the relationship of husband and wife. Of course, there's many a marriage that hasn't discovered that, as people race back to mother-in-law. But that is what the Bible is teaching, that it's got to do with a relationship which takes precedence over all other relationships, because it's a relationship of unity. And so it is a leaving of parents and cleaving to each other, being united physically, sexually together, and being glued together is the idea. It's actually being cleaving together is the coming together physically, and it's got to do with a connotation of continuing together. And so that they become, in fact, one. And in the initial creation, that is reinforced by the lovely picture we see in verse 25, where though they are naked, they have no shame from one from the other, because they live in that perfect unity and fellowship where they have nothing to be afraid of, nothing to be ashamed of in each other's company. They are in that kind of relationship. And so you see, sex is an integral part of God's program for mankind. Thoroughly good, thoroughly right, created by God for mankind to enjoy and to use as his method of becoming one and united. God creates them like that. However, the unity that we have and see there in the end of chapter 1 is not the unity that we see in the rest of the Bible or in life today. Divorce, which is so rampant in our society, is only the tip of the iceberg. Marital discord and unhappiness and misery is widespread. And in a group this large, many of us here come from homes where we know the distress and the anguish and the wretchedness of seeing our families slowly being torn apart. Because we live in the created world, so we still live in the pattern of marriage. But we do not live in the Garden of Eden. We live outside the Garden of Eden. We do not live before the sin of mankind. We live after the sin of mankind. And Genesis 2 and 3 hold together. We'll be looking at the sin of mankind next week when we ask the question, what did Eve eat? A very important question to grasp hold of, what it was that she actually ate and what it means that she ate. But we'll look at that next week and the consequences of that in terms of the fall. But already, to look at marriage, we've got to run ahead and see that the marriage setting that you've got in Genesis 2 is not the marriage setting of today because of sinfulness. And so the judgment came upon not only man in his work, but woman in her marriage. As man is created and given the task of working in the garden, once he sins and the curse of God is upon him, you'll see in chapter 3 from verse 17 onwards that the land now becomes difficult. Man now works with sweat. Thistles are growing. The sweat doesn't mean that he had a different anatomy before this and therefore didn't have sweat glands, which would be an interesting kind of possibility. But it's now hard work, whereas before it was easy work is being implied. Now thorns and thistles grow instead of just the good fruit that you want to grow. Scotsmen take notice of that the thistles are actually part of the curse of God. However, the woman is cursed in her focus of life and her attention, that is, around childbearing and fellowship with her husband, for which she's been created. And so back in verse 16, she has pains in childbirth, and now she will desire her husband that he will master her, he will rule over her, and the word has that dictatorial, nasty connotation. Now, please don't get this wrong. Some people are saying that the Bible is there, so we're saying in verse 16 that this is the way marriage should be. It's not saying this is the way marriage should be. It's saying this is the way it shouldn't be, but it will be. It's not saying that this is the way the garden should be with thorns and thistles. It's saying this is the way the world will be. It shouldn't have been, but it will be. And it's not saying that because it will be like that, you mustn't try and eradicate thorns and thistles. That's not saying, you go ahead, use all the weed killer you want to get rid of those things if you wish. Likewise, it's not saying because you will have pain in childbirth, therefore you're not allowed to overcome any pain. You've got to suffer it to the full. Ah, it's not saying that. It's just saying that this is the way the world will be. And so it will be with a desire and rule. Now, for many years, I understood that a desiring and ruling in terms of something that I've observed in life and could be interpreted fairly from that passage, and most people still interpret it this way. That is, that a woman will be through sexual relationships bound to her husband. A bonding process takes place through sexual relationships. A uniting takes effect psychologically, personally, emotionally. And although she desires her husband will ruthlessly mistreat her. And it is one of the astonishing characteristics that you consistently see in wife-bashing programs, whereby, though the wife is bashed and she has to call in the police to rescue her, when it comes to laying charges, she will nearly always drop the charges and won't press the charges and will continue to go back to him over and over again with a seeming irrationality and complete injustice as men take advantage of the situation. Now, while the passage could mean that, and it does, and certainly that is reflected in life, I don't think it does because of chapter 4, verse 7, where the identical words are used. In chapter 4, verse 7, speaking of Cain and Abel, we read, God speaking to Cain, "If you do what is right, will you not be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must master it." Exactly the same words, the desiring to have you and the mastering of it. And seeing that the context and the usage of the writer are considerations as to how to interpret it, think back into chapter 3, verse 16, and you'll see the desire of the woman is not the sexual longing for the woman, but the desire to conquer, the desire to have and control lies now at the heart of the woman, but yet she will fail because the man will keep mastering her. That is, instead of the picture of harmony and unity in relationship where there is no shame and no fear between the sexes back at the end of chapter 2, verse 25, now from here on in, there will be warfare and hostility as there will be a consistent and continued power struggle between the sexes. But unfortunately, the men will keep winning. The basic reason why men keep winning is because their biceps are bigger, not their brains, of course. But they do happen to have more physical strength, and they do happen to use it when the chips are down in the power struggle of marital life. And that, of course, is one of the great horrors of our society, as all around our civilised community we hear of these dreadful stories of wives being bashed, you see. It's a terrible thing and a shocking thing for which those who have been moved into the women's movement of recent years are absolutely right in complaining and protesting and seeking somehow to alleviate the problem. That's quite right that they try to do it. It's quite right that we try and alleviate the problem wherever and however we can do it, because that is a terrible way to live. And yet, we must face the reality that the Bible says it is the way of the world. And we only need to look at the statistics to find out it is indeed the way of the world, all over the world, one society after another. That is, whenever you enter into sin, you enter into antisocial behaviour. It's the character of sin. It's always antisocial. It is always anti-unity. It is always anti-relationship. And so you cannot lie to one another without pulling apart your relationship. You cannot cheat one another without pulling apart your relationship. You cannot steal from one another. You cannot murder. You cannot commit adultery without pulling apart the relationship. Each of the sins of society are sins which pull apart relationship. It's the character of it. And so warfare is the scene, is the character of the marriage outside of the garden. Mankind, of course, recognises the incompetence that he has for marital unity. But he will not turn back to God to resolve it. Rather, he keeps on trying to solve the problem his own way, which is the character of sin, as we'll see next week. And the way in which most people try and resolve the problem of marital disunity and disharmony is, of course, to rearrange marriage. To say, well, look, that system, that institution doesn't work. We've got to get rid of that institution and find another way of living in harmony. And there's many imaginative alternatives that are available to us today. Many, for example, deny unity or just practice polygamy, have lots and lots of wives, and or polyandry with lots and lots of husbands. Or we have celibate marriages, as some of the Hare Krishnas seek to pursue. Or we'll have trial marriages, which are, of course, a trial to nobody except the people outside. It's a great pain in the neck for them. But it's a trial marriage, which is a nonsense. You can't have a trial marriage. The essence of marriage is that you are united for life. The essence of a trial is that you can break free whenever you want to. So it can never be a genuine trial, can it? The very nature of the institution makes trials impossible. Or we have the pattern of serialized polygamy called divorce and remarriage, which is just a way of doing it one after another instead of all together. Or communalism. There's all kinds of these denials of the idea of being two people united fully, completely, comprehensively for life. All kinds of denials of that. And it's been very popular and fashionable, although there's a shift as each of the alternatives fails. Jermaine Greer, who was very big on it a few years ago now, but nowadays she's writing books about no sex is better than bad sex. A great change, a shift has taken place. Or Margaret Mead, who in the 1920s made popular the Samoan people as people who lived without any of the kind of constraints of Christianized marriage in free, open, sexually liberated societies, which, of course, her work has now been thrown in complete discredit by Derek Freeman in the late 1970s. But in the meantime, for 50-odd years, anthropology courses all around the world taught the Samoan people were just wonderful. Now, of course, we've discovered that they've got the same problems of hatred within their home and divorce and brutality and rape and murder as anybody else. It's just it was seen through very liberated glasses of a woman who didn't want to have the marriage pattern of Christianity. Or you see it again in Bettina Arndt, a local sexologist around Sydney here on the radio station, who's for years been telling us all about the techniques of sex and how that will improve marriages, but is now saying that while that's true, she really thinks the basic fundamental we've got to work on is relationships in which those techniques take place. There's all kinds of people who will knock the institution because they want to knock away at the unity, but in fact, the unity is fundamental to it. And so some people then are now trying to knock the diversity idea and say, unisex is the way forward. We've got to stop talking about men and women. We've just got to talk about persons, or what we really need to talk about is per bodies, don't we? Because we don't want any of that sexist language on persons. And so we've just got to treat every per body as a per body and no longer treat anybody as a man or as a woman, because that seems... But the diversity, the sexual polarity is built into the human nature. It's built into the creation. We have been made in order to be united, and the key to being united actually has to do with this sexual relationship. And so, of course, homosexuality and lesbianism is again another denial of the diversity idea. It's the idea of putting one and one together and winding up with two instead of one, which is God's plan. However, how does the Bible treat the rest of Genesis? What does it do with it? Well, Genesis 3, of course, sets us the whole new ball game when we come to the question of marriage and sinfulness. But the Bible does more to it than just speak about the dreadful state that sinfulness leads our marriages into. Within the Old Testament, the God of Israel is seen as united to the people of Israel in marriage by a contract and a covenant, which is marriage. And so in Hosea and Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel, over and again, the people of Israel are called back to their marriage with God. Not a sexual marriage as such, of course. So, for example, Isaiah 54 we read, "Your Maker is your husband, the Lord Almighty is his name." And the unfaithfulness of the people of Israel to God is seen as an unfaithfulness, an adultery of the bride to her husband. And so it reveals God's attitude towards marriage and towards his plans, as you'll see in a few moments when we come to the New Testament. But already we see in the Old Testament God's values about marriage spelt out. So in the law of Israel, there are chapters and chapters that deal with, or verses and verses which deal with the subject of marriage itself. It has to do with faithfulness. It has to do with purity and holiness and righteousness. It has to do with making a contract with someone and sticking to it. Just as God is treating Israel faithfully, by contract, making his promise and sticking to it, being in a personal relationship with his people. And so there's many parts of the law. Now, we can't trace those out today. They're far too many. But on the back of the outline, you'll see there's reference to a very excellent book which on marriage in the Bible, which I've given quick review to, because it's the kind of book that is not flogged around Christian circles at all, because it deals just with what the Bible has to say, and that's the last thing we want to find out. We, of course, do. We're here in Bible study. But most people on marriage, you see, want the real trendy pop psychology stuff, which will give you the latest techniques to be able to work our marriage better. Whereas Geoffrey Bromley's done a different thing altogether. He's gone to the Bible and looked up every reference that is related to marriage and puts them together in a theological framework, which is enormously helpful, but it's only for those who are serious Bible students. They're the only ones who will benefit at all from the exercise. It's an excellent book. And you can find out about all the laws and values within the Old Testament that God expresses on marriage. But the key one I'll draw your attention to is the idea that the people of Israel are to live as God's bride. Turn with me to Malachi for a moment, will you? Malachi chapter 2. It's the last book in the Old Testament, so we go from the beginning to the end of the Old Testament. Malachi chapter 2. You hit Matthew and head backwards is the way. Malachi chapter 2. The people have just been accused of unfaithfulness to God by chasing after other gods. And then in verse 11, he picks up and gives a marvellous statement about the character of marriage itself. Because the people not only are unfaithful to God, they're unfaithful to their own husbands and wives. Verse 13. Another thing you do, 2:13. Another thing you do. You flood the Lord's altar with tears. You weep and wail because he no longer pays attention to your offerings or accepts them with pleasure from your hands. You ask, why? It is because the Lord is acting as the witness between you and the wife of your youth. Because you have broken faith with her, though she is your partner, the wife of your marriage covenant. Has not the Lord made them one? In flesh and spirit they are his. And why one? Because he was seeking godly offspring. So guard yourself in your spirit and do not break faith with the wife of your youth. I hate divorce, says the Lord God of Israel. And I hate a man's covering himself with violence as well as with garments, says the Lord Almighty. So guard yourself in your spirit and do not break faith. God makes the man and the woman one. Why? Because he is seeking godly offspring. They will come out of that united relationship. And man is made one by contract with his wife. By covenant, by contract. And what a contract requires of you is that you are faithful, that you keep your promises that you made in the contract. And the people of Israel are becoming faithless to God because they're becoming faithless to each other. Because marriage is symbolic of their relationship with God. It's not a peripheral extra. It's not just a kind of a weird fancy on the side of Christianity, of Judaism rather we're dealing with here, but it actually is symbolic of the very relationship between God and his people, made by contract, being united so that godliness might flourish and so forth. But the real thump comes when it comes to Christ and his bride. For it's in the New Testament that we see the marriage image taken one step further. For now it is Christ and his bride, the church, that are united in marriage. Turn with me to Ephesians chapter 5, where you get that passage often read at Christian weddings about the wives and the husbands submitting to each other and loving each other, etc. But it's in this passage in Ephesians 5 that Genesis 2 is quoted. In this same way, verse 28 I'll pick it up from. In this same way, husbands ought to love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. And after all, no one ever hated his own body, but he feeds it and cares for it, just as Christ does the church. For we are members of his body. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. See, Genesis 2 quoted there. This is a profound mystery, but I'm talking about Christ and the church. However, each one of you also must love his wife as he loves himself, and the wife must respect her husband. That is, Paul is saying that Genesis chapter 2 is about Christ and the church, fundamentally, basically, primarily, and secondarily, about you and your partner. It's primarily about Christ and the church. That is, what is God's aim in the beginning? He is creating man in his image to rule the world. How does this image of God come to its fulfillment? In the man, Jesus Christ, who rules the world. And who is this man that God has as the image? This Christ. He is the one who is to live with his bride. And who is his bride? The people whom he has bought. His body. The one that he has purchased. And is now presenting before himself pure and spotless on the last day. The people of God to whom he is being united. The people that God has created for fellowship with Christ. For the service of Christ. For the production of the children of Christ, if you want to push the image that far. What is being spoken of in Adam and Eve, in the creation in the Genesis 2, is really Christ and his people, says Ephesians chapter 5. So if we're going to understand Genesis 2 Christianly, we must understand it in terms of Christ and his people. For it's through the gospel that we become his bride. See, in 2 Corinthians chapter 11, you write it down, I'll read it out. 2 Corinthians chapter 11, Paul says to the Corinthians there,